each of us, we got together and said, how are we ever going to do this? Because in reflecting back on the various proceedings that we had, for instance, the municipality of Anchorage, which has taken up a goodly amount of our time in the past year, just taking the sewer, for instance, we had interveners there. We had the pumper dumpers who felt that they were not being treated fairly. And the water...
I'd like to ask what the pumper dumpers are. Therefore, I won't.
Well, the pumper dumpers are the cesspool people.
Honey buckets.
Yeah, the honey buckets.
Oh, I see.
Yes. And one's name was Dr. Pepper. But in the water utility, we had those people with metered water and those users with unmetered water. We have very strong feelings by some people who, residential people who only have one or two people in their homes as opposed to a large family, that they are being unfairly discriminated against through a rate structure that says regardless of how much water you use in a residence, you pay the same rate. The electrics, I can see very definite interest in, but in looking at the proceedings that we've had, and of course in Anchorage Natural Gas, we did have ACPERG, who was an intervener. But even some, you've got to think of some of the small utilities too.
You've got to think of Golden Valley Electric.
I know the electric heat people in Golden Valley would have felt, on the basis of the staff presentation, that they were not, which would otherwise not be adequately represented.
You're looking one right here.
So. You know, our comments are based on no experience.
Mr. Chairman, I think also the direction of my questions to stop getting on my cross-examining attorney's high horse and getting down to what I was really implying and getting at is that in lines 17 and 18, there is tremendously a high burden for any applicant. And it really is. And if we were to pass this legislation, each of the three commissions would have to have the intestinal fortitude to say no when they had to say no. And if you thought at least in the first year or so that somebody's going to sue you and then lose, they'd end up losing and it would be settled once and for all. And other people prospectively attempting to say that if you look at that high burden, first of all, it's discretionary to you. And then secondly, you have to make, in addition to all these other findings, you have to make a finding that their representation is necessary for a fair determination of the proceeding taken as a whole. So at least the way I read the bill, you would be letting in very few people. Many might apply, and you might have to be very careful in the drafting of your decision or your, if you have an attorney or a staffer drafting, working on it for you, processing the applications up to you, whoever is holding, handing down the denial, maybe you have to very carefully draft the denial. And maybe you have to cite that this is a very high burden, that the finding of this sort is necessary. If you say, yes, you have an interest, but your interest is represented by A, B, and C, is similar to so-and-so who is before the commission, or even if none of the above is true, we find for the following reasons that your representation is not necessary for a fair determination of the proceeding taken as a whole, because we have enough different parties with differing interests before the commission such that we feel we can reach a fair determination without your participation. I think it's a very high burden, and this is the sort of thing that would be used in the very unusual case and not on a day-to-day or even month-to-month basis. And that was the whole direction of the questions that I was asking.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman?
Take a very simple case. No, I don't know anything about personally much is Golden Valley, but you got, I believe, industrial users, residential users who live in the city. who are serviced. Some who live out, those who live in the country who are serviced, who live farther apart, more transmission lines for the number of houses, et cetera. And then you have the total, ones who have total electric, like I do. And it's a very simple case with four major groups, I guess, okay? Now, you cannot say that a proceeding is going to be, you can get a fair determination of the proceeding taken as a whole, at least all, unless all those groups are represented. Very simply because of the rate structure is different for each one. It's not a matter of simply how much per kilowatt hour, it's a rate structure itself. And if you to see the rate structure is fair, you have to have representation from every one of those groups. Mrs. Guest said a minute ago, I suspect that in this water utility case, what it was, they must have had more than four groups. I don't know. But there's absolutely no way you could have a fair determination of the proceeding taken as a whole unless all groups involved, every one of which has different interests in the rate structure, are represented. Now, the real crux of the thing comes down to part two. They can't afford to pay the cost. Now, and again, going back to the case I personally testified on, know about a little bit, the only people who could possibly have paid those costs would have been the industrial users. There's obviously no way that I could have paid, $25,000 or $50,000 to have some expert come in and testify in my behalf as a total electric user. So in essence, I think that almost everybody except industrial users of some sort or commercial users is going to be able to qualify for part two. And every group at least has to be represented in 1B. Now, in which I think 1A and 1B would both be pretty much identical there. Again, only the commercial users would be able to qualify in a 1A, I think, probably. So, and they still do have discretionary authority, but I think that there's going to be a lot of, it's going to be very difficult for the commission to say that somebody is not entitled to unless it's a business which can pass it on to its customers. We had testimony last year in judiciary that these rate cases were costing $250,000, and I see Mr. Sullivan saying that the city of Anchorage spent $800,000 or something, and apparently it's a big money operation.
Well, in order for a third party to be represented and to have an effect on the outcome of the proceedings, the third party has got to have some expert witnesses. He's got to bring in alternatives so it's on the record so that the commission, you know, has something to choose from, and that is an expensive process. I believe our $350 for the consultant fee was a conservative one because they do go higher. We did not feel that the $80 an hour for an attorney experienced in proceedings before.
I'm sure Jack Stern's charging more than that.
I haven't seen what he's charging, but I know what, okay, you know, what some of them are charging, and they're charging a number of them $100 an hour.
Law school, but you should have gone over to.
Bobby had also included. Miss Guest, could I develop a hypothetical case, and if this is enacted into law, how you think the commission might establish regulations? I suspect that for the commission to make a factual determination as to whether it was necessary, I'm looking at lines 17 and 18, which Representative Fairbanks across from me had brought to your attention. Wouldn't it, in other words, for you to determine whether it is necessary to have a group present for a fair determination, it would almost be necessary for them to put on expert testimony for you to make a determination as to what is fair. Now, in such a case, why then, after having this group had brought forth their attorney and their expert witnesses and so forth and so on, and had presented their rationale for being an intervener, why then you decide that, by golly, they're not necessary for a fair determination for these proceedings. I wonder even suggest that you'd have to pay them anyway for having brought these. They couldn't afford to bring these extra people forward for you to make this determination. I suspect that we're going to get caught having to pay them anyways.
You mean the costs, you know?
In other words, let me try again.
Okay,
here I want to intervene, and I am destitute. And I come before you and I say, by golly, it is very necessary for me to be heard as an intervener in this case, for you to come up with a fair determination. And I hire an attorney, or get an attorney, and I get some expert witnesses to try and bring out before you all the facts to try and prove that for a fair determination, I have got to be accepted as an intervener. Then you, the commission, say, after you've heard all this, say, no, we don't need you. Well, I suspect that in that eventuality, and I can't afford to pay any of this, that someplace along this bill and your regulations and everything else that you'll have to promulgate, well, I'll still get paid.
Well, I would hope it wouldn't go that far, otherwise
I'm scared it would.
Otherwise, you'd have the commission sitting in judgment twice, and I don't know legally what implications that would have. But it would seem to me, through the regulations that would be drafted, that you, very much like our regulations, which dictate what information a utility must file in order for a filing to be accepted for a rate proceeding, that, you know, you'd have to have some pretty stringent regulations on why the individual, you know, wouldn't be represented by the staff of the commission. Because now we only have two parties unless a third party intervenes and pays for it. These kinds of things. So I would hope that it wouldn't go that far and the decision would be made on the basis of the documentation, and it would seem to me that that's the risk that the individual would take in deciding that, you know, he wanted to be represented. He might have to put out some money himself. I hope it would not mean that we would have to pay that initial money out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I thought possibly the way it might work is that intervener would based on the regulations call for, would prepare some sort of synopsis of an argument why that it was necessary, you know, for the fair termination. And then you would review that, I'm just guessing, and then you'd sign off, then you'd either allow it or deny it. Mm-hmm. You know, say, yeah, it's necessary for, we believe that it's necessary for definition, which is fair. If you decided against, no, it's not necessary for fairness, then those interveners would have standing to sue and to go in and into a court and say, hey, it is necessary, you know, for fairness. And if you allowed them in because it was necessary for fairness, then I imagine there would be some sort of monitoring thing so they couldn't, be wasteful in their advocacy. That seems to, because I think there is a little inherent problem in what Chad has brought up, but absent, you know, some sort of standardized regulations, so that, you know, you separate the chaff from the wheat, so to speak, at least attempt to.
I get in a couple of questions.
Sure.
Standard procedure now, when somebody wants to intervene, they file a petition to intervene.
Yes.
How frequently do you have interveners then?
We're getting more and more. We're having to get a little tougher because they're not being, they just decide they want to intervene. And as a matter of fact, we just have sent out a couple of denials.
That's what I was going to ask now. Okay. Roughly the average of how many times you approve somebody or...
Well, remember, we operated without an attorney on the commission itself from last March to the beginning of July. And we are tightening up on the interveners because we have had a situation where we, you know, we don't know what perspective they're bringing in, and we're making them define this. Mr. Chairman, I can't give you the actual amount of times. I can tell you that last week I signed off on one denial, and they can come back, you know, outlining what their interest is in the proceeding. But just this sort of tossing the hat in the ring, it does delay the proceedings when truly they don't have a real interest in being there, and their responsibilities to being an intervener, because the way our statute is, our regulations are written, we can allocate costs to interveners, and we do.
Mm-hmm. Just had a question of interest at this all. In a co-op,
yes.
Wouldn't every member of that co-op who receives service from it automatically be entitled to intervention?
Well, theoretically...
Well, I don't know. I'm asking you. It's just a question of information. Golden Valley is a co-op,
yeah.
Rural Electric Co-op. I'm simply asking, wouldn't every one of their members and subscribers, or what you want to call them, be automatically entitled to intervene in a rate procedure? I don't know.
Theoretically, they should be represented by the utility, because the co-op is made up of members of the utility who have... they elect the board members who determine the policy.
But everyone is also a consumer.
Everyone, that's right.
That utility's products, that's why.
I think that the interest in proceedings, as far as the consumer interest in what I have been able to read, the attention has been focused mainly in the electric area. And it's because there are some innovative things being done in terms of rates. They are, you know, the traditional rate structure is a block. There are now flattened rates. There are inverted rates that are being proposed. It seems to me that this is an area, when you had a proceeding, a rate proceeding, regarding an electric utility, in the area of rate structure, not necessarily the revenue requirements. I think the revenue requirements, it would be pretty easy to determine whether somebody is going to bring, you know, additional expertise that you're not going to have. But in terms of rate design, here's where I see that if you're talking about a fair determination, and you know that the utility is proposing this structure, the staff is going to propose this structure, and then you have other innovative things, plus you have lifeline concepts, these kinds of things. I would anticipate in electric proceedings that this, we would have a third party in light of this legislation.
Right. Chairman, I think we can draft a CS for this bill and tighten it up and make it clear that each one of the three commissions has to be tough guys. That is, they have to consider that allowing someone in under this legislation should be the exception rather than the rule. And I think that the bill is practically drafted that tightly now, which was the whole reason for my "have you stopped beating your wife lately" questions at the beginning of the hearing. Because they've just got to be able to say to somebody, "I'm sorry, but we have four other parties already before this commission. They represent so vastly dissimilar interests that your interests will be represented by the nature of an advocacy proceeding among the four of them." And if once in a blue moon, they'll say, "Whoops, you're right. We're not going to be able to make a fair determination in this case, unless we allow you or your group and people like you in here." And I think that if the bill doesn't say that, we should make sure it does and pass it out because it's a good idea. Maybe after we come up with a CS, for instance, I would insert, among other things, tightening up, even though the word "may" is permissive, on line 11, I would, after the comma, after "may," insert the word "in its discretion." and ask that we have a committee report making it clear that that implies the judicial review of the decisions by the, each of the commissions in reviewing denials here would be subject to the same standard where courts review the exercise of discretion of other courts. That is, they would have to find an abuse of discretion. Not merely that had they been sitting on the commission, the reviewing judge been sitting on the commission, he might have reached a contrary result in making the decision, but he would have to find that the commission had actually abused its discretion in disallowing an application under this section. If we put that language in the bill and made it clear in the committee report that this was for the exceptional case where even though you have three or four parties before staffs there, or in communications cases, now that they are finally gearing up the communications carrier section we created a year or so ago, that even with those people there, it's not going to be a fair determination. They know that it's a very unusual case, and give them the leverage in legislative history and statutory language. We can give them a good bill, a tool that they can use when necessary, and move the bill on.
Mr. Chairman, just an observation. I can't help but feel that an approach like was suggested by the representative from Fairbanks, that we're really controverting the very purpose of the Public Utility Commission, which is to protect the public, and we're putting them in a position of trying to adjudicate whether or not the public should be represented or not. This seems to controvert the very purpose of the commission. You have completely confused me as to what your approach is.
Well, in partial reply to that, I think the public has to be differentiated from the consumer in this, and that's real hard, particularly with the APUC, since the two members on there were stamped. I can't remember in statute. I did contra that bill through. Mrs. Guest and Mrs. Knowles, why it's stamped as consumer representation.
But this doesn't say consumer.
Well, I know, but I mean, so there's, all that I'm saying, there's a little bit of confusion there. But now that they're both sitting on there, they're just, they have to do the exact same thing. They don't inherently pack the water for the consumer. Is my point. They behave just like Stu Hall. To do otherwise would be...
I don't think Carolyn behaves just like Stu Hall.
I think they'd be subject to, reversible error or something like that. I don't know, for some other legal term that I know nothing about.
Yeah, I think that it was a misconception when that was passed in the minds of many people. In reality, what we're doing, we're adding public members to the commission rather than consumer members.
I didn't mean to imply that Mrs. Guest and Mrs. Noah should be lackeys for the consumer. I didn't mean that.
Well, in addition to, I didn't really understand Chet's statement that somehow we were subverting the commission's function by making it possible for them in their nearly absolute discretion to provide for participation by other parties just to make sure that there is a fair determination in a particular proceeding before them, which I suggest this bill with the proper CS could do. And I don't think that the federal legislation, which I believe is the Magnuson-Moss Act, subverted the purpose of the Federal Trade Commission. Of course, there, the federal Congress was presented with a difficult problem that we, fortunately, are not presented with. They were presented with a totally unresponsive, moldy, almost inactive regulatory commission who was serving virtually no function, according to the opinions of many of whom I would think a great deal, and that's not true in this case. I want to give the commission a tool with the bill, not hit them over the head with something they don't want. We have to tighten up the language to make it clear that this is supposed to be the very extreme exception to the rule, that's fine. Because I'm hoping that the Consumer Council Bill will pass. Or the Consumer Council Bill, the Communications Carrier Section, already established in many cases, he'll be able to say thanks, but no thanks, you know, and be able to make it stick. But once in a while, you're going to want to be able to.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
I have another question, I guess, kind of bothers me. The taxpayers of the state are going to pay for this if it goes through. Let's suppose it goes through for all these commissions, and the estimates are somewhat high, and so we only come out with a, you know, I don't know, $500,000 a year or something. I'm really questioning, to some extent, just how justifiable that is. Now, if there's a rate hearing on, Anchorage is a problem all different from anywhere else in the state. It's an Anchorage bill, it's got Anchorage interest, and that's really what it boils down to. There's no question about it. Doesn't apply to the rest of the state very much, in my opinion. And you know, if they're going back to my own case, say it was a little co-op utility in my neighborhood, you know, there's quite a bit of difference between that kind of an outfit and a commercial utility being regulated. And I'm not really sure that the member subscribers in the co-op are the ones who bear these costs. The actual proceeding itself and so forth. I'm not really sure that we're justified in taxing people from Ketchikan in connection with that kind of case up in Fairbanks and a little member co-op. It's sort of an example, an extreme example, but in effect, you know, I really have a problem with this. I think we're talking about putting a lot of the taxpayers' money for cases that, you know, that they have no interest in, nothing to gain from.
That kind of reasoning can be extended to everything.
I know it can. I'm simply saying it. And generally speaking, I can see a rationale. Here, I really have a lot of trouble in seeing a justifiable. This is a justifiable use of the taxpayers' money. I really do. And I think that it'll be very difficult to demonstrate that the profit accruing, you know, to these people in general is going to be worth it.
Mr. Chairman, I make the request that. Two of us have to leave at 9:30. Would it be appropriate to have the witness testify on 496 or to enter the street?
Okay.
Or 496.
496. Yeah, we've done over this once before, I think.
Oh, yes, I remember. This is a draft issue from the back of the building. Carol had seen that. We might even have had some communications from the commission.
Yeah,
on this bill, I think we have.
In the first round, as you recall, Commissioner Guess and Billy Barrier discussed what happened with this bill, and the committee adopted the commission's redraft of Section 1 and retained barriers of Section 2. And that's the bill you see before you now.
Mr. Chairman, my point is very simply is this was introduced 422.77. I just wanted to make sure that that is since the commission's had a chance to testify.
There are subsequent written comments by the commission on this bill.
Hopefully, we have one brought.
Mm-hmm. We still have some problems with Section 2.
Do we have those comments, sir?
Yes, they're in the
strongly support Section 1, had problems with 2.
Would you, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to address the problems we see with Section 2?
Yeah, why don't you do that if there's no problem with Section 1?
No problem with Section 1. we do understand the intent of the legislation, Section 2, as indicated by Mr. Barrier. But we go back to what it says here. It says, no new or revised tariff may be filed during the period a tariff filed by that utility is suspended. I understand what that means. That means that when we have one rate proceeding, that the intent was when we have one rate proceeding before us, that somebody doesn't come in and file a totally new rate proceeding on a different test year. However, any change in a utility's rules and regulations, including rates, is a change in tariff. So the example we have given you, for instance, Chugach Electric has been before us for a change in their line extension policy, which has really been a hot issue. You know, how do you charge for line extensions? What? And they totally revamped it. We had two hearings on it. If the way we interpret this section, if this had been law, during the time we considered the CEA line extension, we could not have considered their request for interim rate relief because we presently had a revised tariff in front of us. So we believe that if this section is to be written into law, and as we state, we have had no problem up to this time, in we have had no utility file a totally complete rate filing while we are still acting on another one. We suggest that the words on the same subject could be added on page 2, line 11. You know, I think to say you make a very fine distinction when you talk about amending a tariff versus revising a tariff. We went back to our statute, and the no new or revised is a standard language used throughout our AS 4205. So we still believe the way it's written now could cause some problems.
Any questions?
I kind of, although I sure like the original intention of two, I kind of tilt in favor of the commission on that one. I don't know how the other members of the committee feel. It's well intentioned and could create more problems than it seeks to solve.
Questions, Chairman? Yes, sir. That you don't think that the business of leaving it to the commission's discretion that the public interest will be served gives you the necessary latitude?
Well,
I don't know. I'm just
well, no, because I think this is more administrative paperwork for us.
But that's not discretionary language.
What? Unless the filing of the commission upon finding that the public interest
would
be served.
Be served.
Okay, Charlie, that language in the law means that there's a finding which must be made if someone makes an application. They must find on the facts, if they find on the facts, the appropriate result must occur, and it is not at all addressed to discretion. When you insert words like may or may in its discretion, you do have an entirely different result. This language is not discretionary language. Mm-hmm. It requires them to go out and make a finding once somebody's put them in that position.
That's the use of discretion,
or,
right?
Or raise the issue.
That's their use of discretion.
Making a finding? No, not at all. You can bring an action in the nature of the writ of a writ of mandamus against them to require them to make a finding when you have a law like this.
Well, what I'm driving at, Mr. Chairman, is that when any time you make a finding, you are using discretion of some sort. Every arbitrator, everybody, every judge uses discretion. They may not call it that legally, Mr. Brown, but it's what they're doing. They look into the facts and they use their discretion to make the finding. You know,
well, I guess you and I have a very
different I said it's legal different definition. I guess legal definition of discretion is perhaps something different.
Where would you suggest putting on the same subject? Right after or
during the period of tariff filed by that utility, line 11, page 2. During the period of tariff filed by that utility on the same subject.
Okay. sheriff on the same subject or a redraft of the sentence implying that.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it's not a good way of saying it. Maybe my law professors would be slapping me down. They may hear me say it, but at least in the law, discretion is practically legally sanctioned whim. The standard for changing the result of something involving the exercise of discretion is abuse of discretion, even when the reviewing authority believes it would have accomplished a contrary result. And, you know, that's something far broader than something like making a finding or drawing conclusions. In the law, making a finding is finding what the facts were based on what was before you in a due process proceeding. Not a matter of discretion at all. It's a very different animal.
May I ask a question of Representative Brown? The way it's written now, Section 2, given the situation that I just told you about, Chugach Electric was before us with a revised tariff on line extension. And that line extension policy had been before us from September, and I believe the order went out last week. And there were two hearings on it. Chugach Electric could not have filed a request for interim rate relief with the commission unless we found that the public interest would be served by allowing that filing. Is my interpretation of that section correct?
Upon filing the commission. Yeah, I think so. And I think that they could have required you to make a finding. And if you had ignored an application, they could have brought an action in Superior Court in the nature of an action for writ of mandamus for the court to mandate you to exercise your authority to make a finding. And you would have to consider materials before you, affidavits, whatever sorts of evidence you normally provide, to testimony and so forth. Determine, and then you would be forced to make such a finding under those circumstances, which is not a matter of discretion.
Well, again, I'd like to go back to the fact that, you know, the consultant who recommended this, according to Mr. Barrier, was basing his suggestions on problems, as I understand it, that they were experiencing, some of the East Coast commissions were experiencing. And based on my experience and to the best of the chairman's knowledge, who's been on the commission a much longer period of time, you know, this situation has just not occurred. You know, where we have had a utility file a rate filing on a 75 test year, and before we acted on it, come in with a 76. I must say, we have had a situation, and it was cable television, where we completed our action, and they asked for a petition for reconsideration, and that was denied. And then within 3 months, they had filed another totally new proceeding, but we had finished with the first one. Yes.
At least I don't think it would be that difficult to perhaps come up with a whole new revision of Section 2, making it clear that I have amended filing that the Commission does want allowed. Could be. Perhaps we can get a draft and then get you a copy and get some additional comments.
All right. Well, it certainly is in the public interest to allow a utility to amend a filing, particularly when they experience some increases over which they really have no control, and that's the only reason that they would be, rather than filing the entire paperwork again.
Boy, the more I read Section 2, the more I don't even see how we could draft it. She suggested that we can make sure it's a tariff filed by that utility, like you might have on the same subject. But I can sure envisage situations where you already have existing a tariff application on a particular subject before the commission. Conditions do suddenly change. Now, they change so drastically, they don't just change to the point that you should, you know, ask to allow to add to the record to the existing proceeding and wait to result of the proceeding. They change so drastically that your month-by-month costs have increased so much, say, in the event of another Arab-Israeli war or something like that, that you must then ask to have the asked to have another tariff filed on the same subject. We have to be awfully artful in redrafting Section 2 for me to support it, I think. We can't come up with something.
Spend all that much time on it, hold the bill up for. I think what we'll do is make one attempt at it, and if we can't satisfy everybody on it, just go with Section 2.
Any objection
to that
procedure?
Probably
one sort of got otherwise, too.
Okay, we have one more witness on 469 and 478. Fred's not here from another city, and I'm going to have a good time. I'd also like Fred to talk to the FTC and get some idea of their experience.
They may have already promulgated regulations to give us some idea what's going on. I apologize for that.
Hello,
Michael. You going to see the Gov?
Yep.
Of course, this morning.
Gummy's not necessarily a bad guy. He just submits a lot of flaky letters.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Chris Foster, and I represent the Alaska Public Interest Research Group Lobby. It's unfortunate that the director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, Jamie Love, isn't here to testify, because my remarks are in support of both of these bills and deal with the intervener's view. James Love, and representing the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, intervened recently in a utility case in Anchorage with AGAS, a gas, natural gas supplier in that area. So I would begin my testimony with the caveat that I may not be able to give answers to questions you have about specific problems faced by interveners, but I'd like to assure the committee that I can certainly get those questions answered in a very timely fashion if you should have them. one resource that I looked at while preparing my testimony was a report done by the law firm of Boasberg, Hughes, Cloris, and Cass, attorneys at law in Washington, D.C., which was done in early 1975 for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that looked at the policy.
Thank you for pronouncing it correctly. I know a nuclear engineer who has mispronounced nuclear for the last 20 years. Go ahead.
This report was done to look at the policy implications of funding interveners in rural and, well, they confine themselves to rulemaking cases. There is a copy of this report in the committee room, and I would recommend to members of the committee that it deals very exhaustively with some very troublesome aspects of this subject, one of which is how do you allocate the funds. three suggestions that were made in the report was a threshold approach, that a group that sought to intervene in a case would prove their, now I may mispronounce this, Representative Brown, and I hope you'll correct me if I do, their bona fides by...
Bona fide would be the classical or the church. Bona fide would be the bastardized law Latin pronunciation. Go ahead.
They're bona fides then, okay. to participate in the case. Sort of a put up or shut up approach to getting into the ball game at all, more or less. The other approach discussed in the report is that if, for instance, there are several groups who seek to intervene in a proceeding, that they just all be given each other's information, more or less, or their synopsis of their position, and that a consolidation approach be worked out, an explanation to the parties that there are limited funds available, so on and so forth, and that if they can consolidate their positions, they may all be represented. The other is an approach that I guess is more truly legal in nature, in that at the end of the proceeding, the money is apportioned according to what kind of presentation each intervener has made. The question may well be asked, why is this kind of legislation needed? Even ill-financed interveners have made a difference in utility proceedings and have taken positions that are different from those represented by the utility staff, which of course is the public interest and which of course is hard to define. The question, what is the public interest, is a very hard one to answer. What difference has this made? That's another question that may be asked. Well, in Alaska recently, in the Anchorage gas rate case, the interveners defeated what was known as the Alaska factor, which was an extra 2% profit margin allowed just for the risk of doing business in Alaska, that had been routinely allowed by the commission until the interveners brought the point up. The interveners also, in our opinion, perform a gadfly role. That is, that they make the commission and its staff do their homework, perhaps to a greater degree in some areas than might otherwise be done, but I don't want to by that statement imply that the APUC has not done its homework or has had serious failings in the past, because frankly I'm not that familiar with the workings of the commission. The adversary system or the adversary setup of the proceedings before the APUC is a difficult forum for the average citizen to involve him or herself in. It's more like a courtroom proceeding. Therefore, expert witnesses and in many cases, attorneys must be hired to make these presentations, and it is very expensive. If the committee has any questions as to how much time the intervention by the Alaska Public Interest Research Group took up or how much money was expended, I can get them that information. I know that costs were kept to an absolute minimum, but I'm not quite sure, you know, what the final breakdown on costs was. And as ably stated by Representative Bradley, the members of the commission, the two newest commissioners, Mrs. Knowles and Mrs. Guest, are more correctly called public members than consumer members, because by law they must review each case as full members of the commission and are not two automatic precast consumer votes. So to sum up, it's the opinion of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group that outside interveners help to keep the process of utilities regulation, and this also goes for the ATC and the APC, more open and dynamic. As you're probably all aware, the commission and its staff deals mostly with industry coming in to in rule and rate making proceedings, and there is always a possibility if there's kind of a closed vacuum of association that some form of co-option may over the long run occur, and we believe that to have a mechanism for funding interveners will help keep the process more open and more dynamic. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to suggest something both to the committee and the witness and Mrs. Guest. That and another half sentence since I showed it to Mrs. Guest just now. And I suppose the witness representing her position would not like to have the authority of the commission so absolute, so limited as I was implying out to be in order to make it practical. She can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But I would suggest that as to each of these sections 1, 2, and 3 of House Bill 478, that we make the sections set forth there as sections A, and as to each there be a new section B, which would read, the authority granted under this section is to be exercised as a matter of discretion, and any judicial review thereof shall be limited to a determination of the existence, if any, of an abuse of discretion upon reviewing the record before the commission at the time of the determination. Mr. Chairman, that does two things. That keeps them from being hauled constantly into court, because very few lawyers in their right mind would haul a denial of an application by an intervening party into court on this standard unless they really had a grossly bad case. I mean, it would have to be a totally unfair, patently unfair denial by the APUC or the APC or the ATC of an application to intervene on standards like this, because it both says that the review of the court would be limited to a determination of the existence of any of an abuse of discretion, and secondly, it says upon reviewing the record before the commission. So you could not have a trial de novo as to whether or not an application under these sections should have been granted. I also suggest that if we were to adopt such a section, this committee could, on its own, I believe, substantially come up with substitutes for the fiscal notes from each of the three commissions. I know, I suppose whatever you do in this area is somewhat arbitrary, but we should be able to come up with fiscal notes substantially. Because I think, particularly since the commission knows they're going to have limited funds, each of the commissions knows they're going to have limited funds in these areas, they're only going to grant this unusual kind of intervention in the extreme case. And considering the other safeguards that I indicated that are already in the law with regard to these commissions, I think this does address an unusual case. It might be that they can say, ACPIRG, you don't qualify because we think you can find money anywhere, somewhere else because you've been here before. question, but maybe they won't say that. But I'd like to leave that up to them.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
Is it, if this were to go into law, is it your expectation that ACFERG would come in and seek to intervene and get this compensation for so doing?
For the past rate case, Representative?
Well, any cases that would come up.
Is it
your expectation that ACFERG would intervene in cases where it hasn't done it in the past because it didn't have the money? Is that what you would expect?
That might be possible. I think the first thing that ACFERG would look at, though, is if it was felt that the case had broad enough implications to take on the responsibility for doing it, because as Commissioner Guest testified, there are very definite responsibilities that interveners take on when they engage in this kind of activity, above and beyond the funding problems. There's a commitment of time and manpower that have to be thought about very carefully.
Well, I know, but okay, let's come back to my question, though. My question is it your expectation that ACFERG would be intervening in cases where they would not have done so without the law because of the money problem?
I would say that given...
You made your initial determination, right, this is a worthwhile investment of your resources.
I would say yes.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move another question. Another question for perhaps another possible amendment of this bill. And in subsection 1, I should say, who has represents an interest and so forth, I'm not certain that language indicates that the person who seeks to intervene will be affected by the ruling of the commission. Now, in other words, if there's a Golden Valley case in Fairbanks, ACFERG is an organization down in Anchorage, and they want to come up and intervene in a Golden Valley Electric case, I'm not really certain that they have any right to do that. And no disrespect to ACFERG, any outfit from another part, right? And I think that interest should be, we should narrow that down to someone who not only has an interest, but is an interest who will be, pardon, who will be affected by the decision made by the APVC or the ATC or whoever. Right?
Let me be wrong.
They're the consumer we're talking about, right?
I think that's a requirement now, even intervening.
You want to make sure we don't change that if that is a present requirement.
Well, I don't know. But the point is, if you're talking about consumers and the people who,
talking about standing. That's what
standing involved. Okay, but the point is, if we go to consumers,
in
that particular case, right, then it has to be somebody who will have that standing, who will be affected by it. Right? Not somebody who's, I don't know about the AGAS, is that right? AGAS
mm-hmm.
case?
I
would assume it would have to have been somebody who gets gas from that utility and who is affected by the prices they have to pay for the gas in order to have the standing to intervene at all. If they don't, then they shouldn't be allowed to. That would be my reaction.
I got the language already.
I don't necessarily want the circuit riders.
Right.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
I got language for you already. Change C to B and insert a new B there. By the way, all these switches ought to be who's because we've, who's and whom's because we've said a person rather than a thing. The new B would be who would otherwise have standing to intervene and. Is there any problem with that, Mrs. Guest?
Except I'm not sure where you're putting it. We've got.
So that there be what, the 1, 2, 3.
What line are you?
Under 14, line 14.
Mm-hmm.
The way I'll just very quickly read it the way I'm suggesting it would come out, changing my who, which is to who's. Who has or represents an interest A, or which, yes, that should be which would not otherwise be adequately represented in a proceeding, and, oh boy, you have to change the language. Yeah, because you're talking, because the whole subsections describe the interest and not the person, but I'm sorry, I don't have the exact grammar, but the general idea is that we would add a requirement that the party would otherwise have standing to intervene. That is, if they were under your regulations and Title 42, and they did have $1 million to hire the best lawyer in the world, you would grant them to ride as a party as a matter of course, because they would have, they would meet your standing requirements. So then there'd be three requirements. One, that they would not otherwise be adequately represented. Two, that the sort of person who would have standing under the appropriate standards under the statutes and the regulations. And three, their representation is necessary to impair determination. That's how I would suggest incorporating what Charlie was referring to.
Do you have a comment?
Well, yeah, that is, that may already be self-correcting because the commission determines who's going to intervene.
I know, but there's this whole problem of if we passed this year and the law you're referring to was passed 3 years ago, some appellant might argue that there was an implied repealer of the standing requirement by this bill, unless we so say.
Any other questions? Comments on the
bill? I think it's getting better. Are we going to hear from the transportation people and the pipeline people?
Are we have letters from them, right?
It's in writing.
Oh, it is?
Pandas. Yeah.
Comments
in writing. All and everything's included in the writing.
I see.
Right, right.
What did they say? Lousy idea?
They need to have $1 million.
Yeah. Oh. Transportation commission went first class.
Sorry, I see you going that kind of way.
Oh,
you're getting over there.
It's in. They're all included.
Oh, that's.
They're only figuring $500 per applicant over. There's a distinction between an intervener and somebody who simply wants to testify before the commission. Is that right?
Yes.
I know when y'all had a hearing in Fairbanks, I said he testified. I said it was not an intervener.
No.
But now, and I asked you a question. I assume that the ATC and the Pipeline Commission probably have roughly the, also have the two kinds of people or something. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be a formal intervener to present information to the commission.
No. No.
I was wondering, because Mr. Breeze, I guess it is, was written here about a number of people who worked on the pipeline and who have information about, you know, waste and one thing or another, who'd want to present information. I don't think it was necessary to be an intervener under the sense of this bill to do that.
I did not speak with Mr. Breeze, and so I'm, you know, I'm not aware of his background. I do know that. The reason they aren't here is their case begins today.
Yeah, but anyway, the point is that anyone can present information to you without being an intervener in the proceeding, and that information does go into the record and
yes,
is considered
does.
In making your decisions. Is that right?
Yes, it certainly.
Well, what's the difference between that and the intervener? Then, can you in a few sentences can you tell me what we're talking about funding interveners, I guess, here, and not just the people who want to testify. That's, at least that's the word that's been thrown around here, is intervener, and not witnesses or anything, or testifiers or something.
In a number of communications proceedings that we have before us, particularly in the area of certification for small telephone utilities in rural Alaska, RCA has been filing as an intervener. They have an interest in the proceedings in that they are the long lines carrier and they could be affected by a decision that the commission would make.
What does that the filing exempt tribunal, what
okay.
do they what do they gain by doing all that right. over being simply test over simply testifying?
So they gain the rights to cross-examine witnesses okay. and to present their own witnesses.
Right, now we're getting it.
And to bear their share of the costs of the proceeding. The end of a proceeding, the commission allocates cost in many instances, you know, the cost, for instance, to transcribe the, you know, I think they're 3 feet high, and Susan Knoll's office, the AGAS proceeding, is a tremendous cost.
But the intervener then can cross-examine witnesses, so whether a simple witness, an average witness, so
that's
can't
right.
do that.
The, you know, the average witness comes and he's, you know, he presents his testimony, and then the utility has to write to ask him questions, and the staff counsel and the commission asks him questions.
Right.
But no, the intervener has the status of not only bringing their own witness, but cross-examining other witnesses.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't really clear on that distinction.
They're also required, then they must be served with all documents
yes.
by all other parties and by the commission for the rest of the life of the proceeding.
That is correct. An individual can also get on a service list, too, but if a party has failed to notify the intervener, then he has rights before us, in, before the proceeding even starts.
Well, it's a defective filing. I mean, you can't act on it until there's a proof of service upon all the persons, yeah. including the intervener. I would believe that's true of the court and most other administrative witnesses.
I'm going to make a couple of observations. Basically, what I heard here today. First of all, it seems to me that if the APUC staff has anything to say about these intervention fees, your suggestion of it is a terrible conflict of interest because in many cases, interveners, consumers, or whatever are going to have positions adverse to the staff. This is quite a sword that the staff can hold over someone that they think could be very troublesome. The problem with the fees there. It shows you, or it suggests to me that, or it really reiterates the fact that the public interest represented by the staff and the commission, you know, is many, many times divergent from the consumer interest and the staff and the commission, despite whatever nomenclature you give you. You have the staff here and the commission here are really intertwined. Because here the commission suggested itself that the staff would be burdened by making these determinations. I'm not denigrating the commission for that. That's something I think the committee would think about. Representative Parr is concerned about the co-ops. Now, it does seem to me that the greatest benefit interveners would get through this kind of funding or the Consumer Council would be in rate cases. However, in terms of co-ops, I could think of some things, and I think representation of the ratepayers or members would contribute, perhaps in improved service, increased awareness of the management of the co-op and their prerogatives, how they're you know, making management decisions that directly affect the utility's customers. That's not something you put to a vote very well in a cooperative members meeting. In terms of rate structure, that's another matter that in a meeting of, an annual meeting of Chugach or Golden Valley, you can't really take votes on who's going to pay this much for all electric or whether they'll have declining block rates this year Now, that's the only control is on the directors. It just suggests to me that for the co-ops and municipal utilities, there are some benefits, while it may not all be in rate cases, benefits to the ratepayers down below.
Of course, the obvious rebuttal to that, Strange, and I'm sure you're aware, is that you have a co-op, you have a democratic process, you're like electing legislators. You don't, how is it? You know, know, and if you don't like those directors you've chosen, you can throw them out. And, you know, I'm not, we don't necessarily have to vote. The body politic doesn't vote on every bill we pass here either. You know, they elect us, we're delegated to do certain things. So I really should have, you know, that analogy would hold too.
Well,
as a consumer of Golden Valley, it's my own problem. It's not the problem of those people who live in Anchorage or in Ketchikan or in Barrow. You know, if my director is doing a poor job, that's my fault as a voter in that cooperative. Why should they pay any money for that?
Is there proxy solicitation in cooperatives?
No.
But it'd be interesting to make a study of how many incumbent directors or management nominated directors have ever been defeated.
Well, I agree with Charlie on that. I'm just suggesting that there may be some help to the person who's picking up the tab and getting a little better footing in how the services directly affects them.
May I ask Mr. Grandjean a question in regard to your first statement? You are concerned that even though during the adversary proceedings, the commission and staff are separate, that did I gather from what you said that you support the position of the commission that it's more advantageous for the determination of who is going to come before the commission as an intervener to be made by an agency outside the commission as opposed to the commission or its staff?
No. It seemed to me that your testimony at the outset was that the fiscal note and its magnitude would generate because of the staff that would be necessary to process these applications.
Oh, the personal services, there are three people: your attorney, your financial analyst, and your support, your secretary. The weight of our fiscal note is in the monies that we believed on the basis of 1976, on the hearing, the proceedings before us in 1976, would be necessary for attorney's fees, and intervener's got to have an attorney. And we found ourselves, when we had to go out and hire an attorney in two cases, when the AG could not provide the staff, the commission went outside and hired the attorney, and I believe you know who he was, and we paid a law firm close to, I think, $28,000 for two cases. We now have that same attorney on our staff working full-time for the commission.
A lot cheaper than
that. You bet. Yeah, the contractual services on attorneys is, so we have $100,000 if the third party is going to be represented by individual attorneys, and then the $266,000 for the consultant. So I feel that the weight of the fiscal note is there as opposed to staff for the commission.
Well, I merely suggest that the committee consider, and perhaps the commission has already done, since it is the commission itself that makes the determination of who has standing to intervene, that it should only be the commission. If the committee adopts the bill, since it is, that makes a determination on these fees, and that the staff, well, may have input, it should have no decision making.
If you petition to participate in the form of pauperis or as an amicus curiae for the Supreme Court of the United States, the justices or an individual justice decides that no law clerk or staff or anything like that.
Mr. Chairman, do we have legal authority to prohibit any use of attorneys before the commission? That would give us a consumer's law more of a break in the long run than the way we can give them.
Can we just unilaterally disbar?
No, I don't mean disbar. I'm just saying prohibit any attorneys from practicing before the commission. That's all. Make them compare without any attorneys whatsoever, and the rate proceedings would cost less, would last less time, and the consumers would probably profit in the long run, as well as the taxpayers.
I don't quite believe that. All I'd like
that's
to
an interesting idea.
No? Okay.
It's not a conflict of interest to me, for me to disagree with you, Charlie, since the conflict of interest law forbids me from practicing before the House of Public Utilities.
I lost one client because I can't practice before the Alaska Transportation Commission.
I just expected that the consumers would save money on.
Get started and take a look at Senate Bill 75 for us. We have the draft back on the CS. It's going to be signed out. You may want to just look it over to make sure it's no problems with. In addition, we also had some questions about House Bill 327, which is the energy, Alaska Energy Corporation.
Buckholz.
Yeah, and got a better understanding now of what that provision requires, in that there was some concern that the 20% or the 120 index would eliminate some communities, whereas in reality what it actually does is mandate the inclusion of all communities over 120, and that 15% reduction in 15% advantage they get on royalty oil doesn't cover it, and you know, but the
they could still sell the stuff, or
yeah, they have to sell it whatever price will get the cost down to that 120 index, so that there's a good likelihood that the corporation will have to be subsidized by the state beyond just the 15% advantage it will get on royalty oil.
Well, that was the question I was asking. Was they also whether they would be able to, make a little money on one place?
Well, no.
And pool all this to take care of some place that had a 200 index or something, trying to bring it down.
We'll take a closer look at the bill. Rather than making money, they're going to be heavily subsidized from the general fund.
I think the fiscal note only covered.
Yeah, I'm going to have Ken Humphrey give more accurate fiscal note. Fiscal note appears to be much higher than we originally anticipated.
On the committee substitute for Senate Bill 75, as you can see, all the amendments and papers that are in there.
Yes, is this a new one?
All of them. The ones
that we said were not controversial or that we didn't mind?
Yes, except that on that long amendment they wanted, where the committee just adopted the first paragraph, that was 2835080. What the troopers wanted to accomplish basically was up the limit to $500, as I understood it, and do away with the requirement of a written report by a driver if the accident was investigated by a peace officer. Now, it's why they did this, I don't know, but they attempted to rewrite the section, and that didn't really work too well, but they were going to do away with the requirement, perhaps inadvertently, of somebody notifying a peace officer that they had an accident. That's the first section, 2835080A. So I rewrote the section to accomplish what I thought they wanted to do. As you'll see, those sections A and B.
They're on page 3, right?
Yes, 2835080A. That just amends those two sections. I think that's what they wanted to accomplish. Could have been an inadvertence. Basically, they were overlooking Section 8. I don't think the committee wanted to do away with that requirement.
Oh, wait a minute.
I see, they just have to tell them about it. It's not any kind of written notice. This is just the, hey, there was an accident thing. I mean, hey, is that right?
No, what I'm saying is, the way the troopers had the section of the act written, I think they inadvertently were omitting the requirement of notifying police officers that you just had an accident. So I kept the sense of their ideas to accomplish all that, just amended A and B instead of rewriting the section. And I think it does. It raises the ante to $500. And then
you don't have to file a report for the accident has been remitted.
Yeah, that's what they wanted, that way.
Was that? Now, one little difference, and I don't know if it's intentional or whether I misunderstood initially, but I guess I thought the investigation by peace officers, you bump fenders with some guy, somebody, you know, and so the cop comes along, the state troopers, and they look at it and make their report. But you've got it here that if it's investigated by a peace officer within 10 days of its occurrence, so if you have an accident, then you get your car pulled off a road or something and you go on about your business or whatever it is, and then 4 or 5 days later the guy comes along. I don't, was that the intent too, or?
The,
we didn't have that within 10 days. No,
that's why I'm asking you a question.
Yeah. Okay, they extended the time to 10 days to send in the accident report. And I went over this with legislative affairs law. That's point that they didn't really discuss, and that's really a policy choice for the committee, is should that report by the driver be obviated if the accident is investigated on the scene or at the time of its occurrence, or any time within the 10 days afterwards? Or should the accident, the trooper, or should the driver know that if a trooper hasn't investigated an accident within 5 days and he's got 5 days left to get his report, or should he hang till there are 10 days? I don't know, and the troopers didn't really discuss that part. So that's I think a policy choice for the committee.
Sure. Okay. Well, if it's anything other than just a minor fender bender, you're going to see that police officer before you leave the scene of the accident, unless you're going to run and committing a misdemeanor or felony. You're going to see a warm body with a badge on it in most cases. It might not happen way out in the middle of Mr. Swanson's district, the highways and all that, but even then you're not in a position to move. Somebody's going to try to show up. So I think we just ought to leave it the way we had it. If the accident is investigated by a peace officer, I would presume, and leave out the within 10 days of its occurrence, I would presume that that would then kind of put the burden on the guy to find out if it was investigated by a peace officer.
Well, I don't, Mr. Chairman. One thing that we've kind of assumed here is that you've got a two-car accident, but you know, people do frequently have one car, they run off the road, just get on the ice, the car goes over, maybe rolls once, and nobody gets hurt particularly, but you know, it's a lot more than $500 damage to the car. And if you come out of our you call up a wrecker and have somebody come out and tow you back onto the road, go on about your business, you know. And I don't know whether that would be investigated in such a case. I mean, unless the troopers happened to come along or somebody reported it to him or something. I don't have any problems with it. I just want to know whether it was an intentional change or change because the troopers wanted to change that within 10 days or what.
No, that was discussions I had with legislative affairs on how to...
Did the troopers object to this?
No.
Does Bill go to another county?
We can check it out with them and see if it meets what they intended to accomplish. And bring up again if we want, once we've cleared it with them. We've got 442 back up this morning. Did anybody want to testify on this morning, or other than, okay. We should get a copy of the bill with all the amendments that were proposed so far, right? And I think there was a general consensus among committee members last time that we wanted to not diminish the role that the legislature plays in the power authority. And Mr. Barrier suggested a series of amendments that will meet the concerns that were expressed last time. And Bill, do you want to just run through those amendments?
Sure. Like,
just to remind me, our situation is that he's responded to a concern by the committee that there doesn't seem to be enough participation.
Bill, every member has an annotated thing like this.
The concern of the committee was when the
line, page by page,
power line 30 line. Legislation was originally passed, the legislature had a fairly prominent role in the affairs of the authority. By intended response to the legislation. Proposed Article 442 would eliminate much of that participation by the legislature. And I think the committee generally decided that we didn't want to make those changes. And that's the amendments that Mr. Berry has taken care of there.
Mr. Chairman, the instructions I had in drafting this were there were certain specific amendments suggested, and the general instruction to take anything out of the bill that in effect changed the power relationships. What what these changes basically were two. One was a change by which legislative confirmation of the board and of the executive director were removed. I had commented that, of course, under Bradner versus Hammond, this would not be confirmable. The other were a series of changes by which the governor's involvement and the governor's power was extensively expanded in this connection. The amendments as made actually go to the to taking out the additional authority that the governor, that the amendments gave the governor over, or the additional power that the governor, the amendments gave the governor over the authority. The first amendment is on page 1, line 19. I'll just discuss these latter amendments. The others were apparently quite specifically discussed. Under the original bill, the committee itself selected the chairman. Under the governor's change, the governor appoints the chairman. In order to make that change, wait a minute, I seem to have the wrong copy. I'm working from the wrong copy. In order to make that change, a change needed to be made, a correlative change, on lines 7 through 15 on page 2. 7 through 15 on page 2 set up the quorum and the methods of operation of the authority. I might incidentally point out that they did not repeal 040, which says that the chairman that the authority shall elect its own chairman. So the bill, as you had it before, you had conflicting provisions, one set calling for appointment by the governor, one calling for election by the members. Under the general instructions, the one calling for the election of members seemed to be the one that was in line with the committee's views, so I took out the sections dealing with appointment by the governor. The second change is on line 2, page 2. The directors under the original bill served for fixed terms. This provides the directors at large, including the chairman, serve at pleasure of the governor. That language was removed. The next change is on page 9. Under this, the regulations of the power authority must be consistent with the state plan and must be approved by the governor. The state plan is prepared by the Department of Commerce and is in effect an administration thing. Under this, that plan would override anything that the authority had done. The changes on lines 3 to 5 and on 8 and 9 on page 9 are directed to this problem. Again, it's a removal. On subsection F, which is 10 to 12 on page 9, provided that loans in, or groups of loans in excess of $1 million must be approved by the governor. Then this was deleted, again going on the general instruction that the power relationships were to remain unaltered. Lines 24 and 25 required approval by the governor prior to the legislature approval. This was deleted. And on page 10, there was a requirement of submission to the governor at least 60 days before the legislature and requiring the governor to make a rather formidable set of findings of fact. The findings of fact I did not address as to the desirability. This did not relate to the power relationship and whether these are useful or not as a matter of policy, but the general policy of not changing the power relationships required a change here. So I deleted the language on lines 23 through 28, but in order to continue the thought, I substituted, the proposal shall contain findings of fact by the authority regarding the following items. The effect of that is to remove the requirement of 60 days prior submission to the governor and place the authority rather than the governor in a position of making the findings. On line 12, section 16, the section A under this makes the authority subject to the provisions of the Executive Budget Act. Currently, under the law as it exists, they're required to submit their budget through the governor and to be put in the budget according to the Executive Budget Act, but the remaining provisions of the Executive Budget Act do not apply, i.e., transfers of funds do not require governor's approval, new positions do not require governor's approval. This, in effect, would give the governor the control over the power authority that he has over the line departments. So, again, on the rationale that this is a change in the distribution of power, I deleted A, which would leave B just as a new section to be added. And the last change was on line 20, section 13, deleting the repealer of 4456.110B. That's one of the bonding provisions that require requires the authority in bonds to covenant that it will maintain such rates as will be adequate to repay the bonds. They say that this is a technical requirement, but from a little experience with bonding, it struck me that this is a very dangerous requirement unless approved by bond council. It's something that in any bonding bill I've seen that they have required as bonding boilerplate. And I delete bonding boilerplate with great caution. So I think this explains the changes I had made other than the changes that were specifically requested. I think you have a list of each of the changes. Out of the changes that you'd requested, there was one minor grammatical change. You had covered the same. You had used the same wording twice, so I deleted it and used it only once. But other than that, the changes were made as they came over from the committee.
Any questions for Mr. Rarick?
So now, Bill, the car relationships are the same as they were, as far as you can tell?
With the one exception of the confirmation. In confirmation, Bradner versus Hammond changed that.
Mr. Chairman? One question. Billy, is it a legal problem or what? The membership of the authority, is it legal to ask for confirmation by the legislature?
It's just flatly unconstitutional. We went to court on that last year, and I thought we were going to win, but we didn't.
That answers that.
Even I thought it was constitutional. I didn't vote for the Ram Bill.
I still think it is, but unfortunately, the Supreme Court said it isn't, so it isn't. Right.
However, the Brandon versus Hammond case is limited just to confirming lower level executive.
I don't agree with that interpretation of the case. I think Bradner versus Hammond flatly says the Constitution is going to be construed strictly, and only officers subject to confirmation are those specifically mentioned in the Constitution. When you get to boards and commissions, that's quasi-judicial and regulatory boards. And I think the case is unfortunately rather explicit.
Jim is right with regard to holding Eric right with regard to the dictum, but in the broad policy matter, I agree with you. Court is not going to change the broad process.